Hello and welcome to KTOO's very own Juno Afternoon. It is October 22nd and we've got a great show. We'll be chatting with the Juno World Affairs Council about their panel on water, get a preview of the Juno Symphony Fall Concert, find out about a new film, Teton Gregory Research film called Paradise Waits and Arts Up. All that and more. Stay tuned.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The White House announced this week it will host the 2015 Tribal Nations Conference on November 5th. Leaders from each of the 567 federally recognized tribes are invited to meet with President Obama and his cabinet in Washington, D.C. Last year's conference focused on young people, which again this year will have an emphasis on increasing opportunity for them. Tribal leaders from across the country bring priorities to the table, such as health care, education, and housing. Many are meeting this week in San Diego, California, for the National Congress of American Indians Gathering. NCAI Executive Director Jacqueline Peta says tribal leaders are strategizing at NCAI for the upcoming White House conference.
We need to think about those things that are critical for us to complete during this president's administration, or the things that we need to get started so that they can transcend into the next administration. Part of that conversation will be centered around that, and so that we could put real win-win, but reasonable, realistic recommendations on the table that we can get done before this president's term ends.
The November White House event will be the seventh such gathering. One of Obama's campaign promises was to meet annually with tribes to strengthen the government-to-government relationship. An Ojibwe tribe in northern Wisconsin is trying to seed more wild rice on its reservation. As Natalie Jablonski reports, Red Cliff hopes to bolster interest in traditional harvest methods.
Paddling the sloughs of the Raspberry River, fisheries biologist Mike Defoe is scattering grains of wild rice, or monomin, into the muddy water.
Part of the method is to just broadcast it and spread it as much as you can. I mean, like, it may be a little too deep right in here for it to even grow, but, you know, obviously along the edges is your best bet.
Even though it's a food that Ojibwe tribes in the upper Midwest have eaten for centuries, there's never been a lot of wild rice growing on Red Cliff land. Tribal members usually travel off the reservation to inland lakes or the nearby Bad River to harvest rice by canoe in late summer and early fall. But in recent years, Red Cliff has been trying to plant rice in new areas that could offer the right conditions closer to home. They're finding it's not always easy to establish a new rice bed. Defoe says so far the seeding project hasn't grown enough rice to feed many families. But he's hopeful, and the tribe's chief conservation warden, Mark Duffy, says it's a symbolic act as well as a practical one.
We came here for the aspect of food that grows on the water, which is rice. And now having it back here in somewhat of an abundance, not a great abundance, but somewhat, it makes everybody feel better, makes their spirit more whole here on the reservation.
Duffy says planting rice also sows the seeds for keeping the traditional harvest alive into future generations. For National Native News, I'm Natalie Jablonski in Red Cliff.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service posthumously honored Alaska Native advocate Katie John. The Athabascan woman long fought protecting subsistence rights. Her son Franklin John says his mother is a statewide treasure.
It started out that she wanted a fishing spot, and then it ended up like the whole state. She represented the whole state at the end, and I think that's important.
John says his mother continues to be a leader even after her 2013 death, and adds there's still work to be done on Alaska Native hunting and fishing rights.
We want to have a voice with fish and game, and federal and state. I'd like to see that one day.
Katie John was also a language and culture bearer. She had more than a dozen children and took in many more into her home. Franklin and other family members were among those present last week in Anchorage for her honoring of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's Conservation Hero Award. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Support for this program is provided by the Native American Rights Fund, reminding you that sovereignty is not free. For 45 years, NARF has stood firm for justice in Indian country on critical issues such as treaty enforcement, hunting and fishing rights, Indian child welfare, religious freedom, and more. You too can become a modern-day warrior. Stand firm with NARF. Learn more at NARF.org and join the fight for Native rights. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Welcome to Juneau Afternoon. It's 5 minutes past the hour. It is 50 degrees at the airport. Downtown it is 50, and Mendenhall Valley is 49. It's going to be keep on raining tonight. There will be rain showers, lows 39 to 45, and tomorrow rain showers likely, highs around 45, and tomorrow night mostly cloudy. That's chance of rain showers. That's the best weather forecast we've had in a while. Well, we've got a wonderful show. We're going to go right into it. We have Bruce Patello in the studio with us. He is here because the World Affair, Juneau World Affair Council, is having their World Affair Forum this weekend starting tonight. It's the politics of water. And also in the studio with us is Professor McCaffrey. He's a distinguished professor of law, one of the world's foremost authorities on international water law. He's here along with six other panelists to talk about water this weekend. So, Bruce, tell us what's going on.
Joan, every year the World Affairs Council hosts a three-day forum on some topic or region of the world. This year we've focused on the politics of water, by which we mean both issues of shortage, how they get allocated, but also consequences of quality of water, or in some parts of the world, obviously, as we look at climate change, excess of water and what those implications might be in terms of impacts on peoples who are forced to migrate either because of drought or because of flooding. We start our program this evening at 7 o'clock in the Egan Lecture Hall with Professor Vernon Scarborough, who will be focusing on, who is an anthropologist from the University of Cincinnati, who will be focusing on basically ancient cultures and how they dealt with water issues and what they may have to offer this modern world in terms of strategies that they had. The program continues tomorrow afternoon, again, in the Egan Lecture Hall at 2 o'clock. We have Richard Kyle Paisley from the University of British Columbia. Richard is going to be speaking. Well, his topic is the good, the bad, and the ugly, experiences and lessons learned with governance in international waters from around the world. He is a colleague of Professor McCaffrey's, and like Professor McCaffrey, has done extensive work under various United Nations regimes and reflecting on that experience. That'll be followed by Brett Walton of the Blue Water Circle. He's a journalist who has focused his career on looking at water issues primarily within the U.S., but also internationally. And that brings us then to tomorrow night's evening at Egan Lecture, which takes place in the library. And for that, Steve McCaffrey is our keynote speaker. Perhaps I'll stop right there, and then I can review Saturday's program a little later, just to give the listening audience a little bit of a taste of what's going to happen tomorrow night.
Absolutely. Professor McCaffrey, thank you so much for coming in
today. It's a pleasure to be here.
So what can we talk a little bit about what you'll be talking about tomorrow?
Sure. My job is, as I see it, is basically to give a broad overview of the picture of fresh water in the world today and tomorrow, and then to talk about international law and to ask the question whether international law can help us deal with a world whose access to water is diminishing. And that might seem strange in Juneau with the rain we're having now here. But in fact, the amount of water on Earth has not changed for billions of years. And yet the population of the Earth is growing. And the United Nations Population Division projects that by 2050 there'll be over 9 billion of us here on planet Earth. So fixed supply, growing demand, developing countries are developing, which often means they use more water. They build dams, which are a favorite, or have been anyway, of the World Bank as a means of promoting economic development. Those dams consume water in that you get evaporation from the reservoir. Water from the reservoir is often used for irrigation. You get evapotranspiration from plant surfaces. So you don't really lose that water, but you lose it from the river or the drainage basin because it evaporates. And it may come down there, it may not. And so you have disputes in the case, in cases where the rivers in question are international. And there's something like 273 international drainage basins in the world that cover close to half of the Earth's surface, 40% or so. And so you can just see from the very rough sketch I've given already that the potential for disputes between countries over this precious resource is increasing with time. And, of course, none of us hopes that the result is going to be more disputes. But Mark Twain is reputed to have said, no one's able to find where he said this, but it sounds so Twain-esque that we'll assume that he said it. Whiskey's for drinking and water's for fighting over. And so, I mean, unfortunately, this plays out. Not the whiskey part so much, but the fighting over water, conflict. It's not always armed conflict. In fact, it's usually not armed conflict, but conflicts over water have played out and are increasingly playing out across the globe.
Right. And just our southern neighbors in California and Oregon with the well wars, that I heard that quote, Mark Twain quote, recently in an NPR piece about, you know, whose water is it and whose well is it and so on and so forth.
Yes.
Let's talk about disputes for a second, mm-hmm. okay? So you were talking, hopefully, well, let me not paraphrase. The question is this. Give us a snapshot of the last 50 years' disputes about water.
Yeah.
International disputes about water.
Well, I'll start with a phenomenon that when you think about it makes sense, but when I say it, you'll think, no, how can that be? Which is that on a river, if the river flows from country A to country B historically will almost inevitably have developed sooner than country A. Country A develops, including developing its water resources, later than country B. All you have to think about is Ethiopia and Egypt on the Nile. Egypt, as we all know, has been irrigating with Nile water for 8,000-9,000 years, depending on whom you ask. Ethiopia, on the other hand, relies mainly on rain-fed agriculture, but is now starting to build dams on the Blue Nile, which contributes about 60% of the water reaching Egypt. And so that holds the potential for disputes between states. And indeed, since the middle of the last century, various Egyptian officials have been threatening to go to war with Ethiopia because of Ethiopia's plans. Sometimes they are completely unrealized plans, but still Ethiopia's plans to build dams on the Blue Nile. And this frightens Egypt because they rely entirely on the Nile for their water. They don't produce any endogenously within Egypt. So that scenario plays out all over the place. You have Turkey on the Tigris and Euphrates, which only recently, in the last 20 years, has built dams on the headwaters of those
major rivers which flow through Syria and Iraq, of course. And they are taking water from the reservoirs behind those dams and irrigating thousands of hectares. A hectare is, you know, over 2 acres. Thousands of hectares of land. And again, sometimes those irrigated hectares are outside the drainage basins of these rivers, which means the water isn't going to return to the rivers. It'll go somewhere else. It won't go downstream to Syria and Iraq. And even if they are within the basins, you have the same problem of evaporation from ditches, evapotranspiration from plant surfaces, and so forth. So Syria and Iraq are very concerned that they'll get less water from these rivers, on which they rely very heavily. So that those are just a couple of sort of quintessential situations that have existed for a while, but they're not going to get better. They're going to get worse. I can talk about the number of disputes, which is increasing, that have been brought before the World Court that involve international rivers. I've been involved in a number just since the 1990s. So you can pretty much verify what's happening by empirical evidence in the form, well, many forms, but among other things, in the form of disputes that are actually submitted to judicial settlement in the World Court or arbitration in the Permanent Court of Arbitration.
Fascinating. Yeah. That's the politics and the law of water, and that's what this whole weekend's going to be about. Is that true, Bruce?
That's absolutely right, Joan. And we start from this very broad focus of looking at the international situation. On Saturday, we start changing our focus to more of a national setting. We'll begin. It does obviously have some international repercussions. Looking at the Colorado River Basin. And Dr. Ned Andrews will be making presentation on that 100-year history of water disputes and resolution, which has both several states, but also is transnational in its effects on U.S.-Mexican relations as well. And then we'll take a look at specifically California. Leslie Gallagher, who is involved with the Central Valley Water Authority, will be, again, focusing on the California experience and both in dispute resolution and, again, the question of water allocation. We spend the afternoon turning to Alaska, and Jim Ayers, who is well-known to many of the listeners here, most recently the regional vice president for Oceana, will be looking at various water disputes in Alaska, those that are already here and those that we know are coming, looking at the Arctic, looking at the transboundary issues we have with northern BC and Canada more generally, and issues of ocean acidification, which have incredible implications for not only our own fishery, but worldwide food basket. And we conclude our Saturday sessions and the conference overall with a panel discussion among all of our speakers.
Well, Bruce, well, if you're just joining us, we're talking with Bruce Patella and Professor McCaffrey about the Juneau World Fair World Forum this weekend. It's the politics of water. It starts tonight. It goes through Saturday. You probably have it all on the website, correct?
Right. If people would go to JWAC.org, they'll find the full schedule. Again, University of Alaska, Southeast, Egan Lecture Hall for everything except tomorrow evening's program, which is in the library. It's open to the public. There's no charge. People are free to come. To anyone, drop in or enjoy the entire session.
It sounds really fascinating. Professor McCaffrey, thank you so much for coming by. And Bruce, thank you so much for organizing the 10th World Affair Forum and bringing all these panel experts here to Juneau. It's a great opportunity. You should go check it out on their website. We're going to take a short break and we'll be right back.
Thank you very much.
Well, shall jump in that paddle wheel thumping. Black water keeps rolling on past to the sea.
Oh, black water, keep on rolling.
Mississippi moon, won't you keep on shining on me?
Oh, black water, keep on rolling.
Mississippi moon, won't you keep on shining on me?
Oh, black water, keep on rolling.
Mississippi moon, won't you keep on shining on me? Yeah, keep on shining your light. Gonna make everything great. Mama gonna make everything alright. And I ain't got no worries, 'cause I ain't in no hurry.
It is 22 minutes after the hour. You're listening to Juno Afternoon on KTOO. Jeff Brown is the producer and engineer of the show. I'm Joan Partist. I am your talking head on Thursdays. Our next guests are Laura Haywood with the Juno Symphony and Troy Quinn, the new conductor. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you, Joan.
So this is pretty exciting. So it's going to be Troy's inaugural concert this weekend. It's at 7 o'clock with a pre-concert talk, and that's going to be where?
It's actually at 8 o'clock.
Oh, great.
But the concert is at 8 o'clock, and the pre-concert talk is at 7, and that's Saturday, and they're both at JDHS. There's a second concert on Sunday where the concert starts at 3 and the pre-concert talk is at 2.
That sounds great. Yeah. So American conductor Troy Quinn is quickly establishing himself as one of the generation's most versatile young artists. Lauded for his energetic and riveting yet sensitive conducting, Quinn is the newly appointed music director, as we discussed. He's also the music director of the Ocean State Symphony Orchestra of Rhode Island, and his past engagements have taken him all over the world. And he's here in our studio, and we're excited. So how has it been coming to Juno and getting our musicians ready for the first concert with
you? Oh, I'm excited to be here, Joan. It's been wonderful. They've been working very hard, and, you know, they've just been progressing so quickly and getting involved in the music and excited about the repertoire. So, you know, I'm happy to be here to work with them.
That sounds great. And what is the repertoire? What?
Well, the title of the concert is New Beginnings, so it has this obvious theme of new starting beginnings, and so we are doing Dvorak's New World Symphony, which is his one of his most famous known symphonies. It was composed in the late 1800s, and so it was his first arrival here to America, and upon hearing and seeing America, his sort of influences, and so it's kind of appropriate for me to be here, my first new arrival. And that's our big work. We're also doing two other pieces, Shostakovich's Festive Overture, which is a wonderful, rousing, kind of very fun work, about a 6-minute overture with lots of brass and percussion. And then another piece we have a soloist coming in, Luann Holmesy, who's our violin soloist. And that's going to be the Meditation from Thais by Massenet, and that's an opera. And this is a very short 6-minute work from his entr'acte.
That sounds great. So how many people are in the symphony?
Right. We have actually about 50 local musicians, which is pretty incredible. And then we have about 15 or so out-of-town musicians joining us. So there'll be 66 musicians on stage, a full Concert Symphony Orchestra.
That sounds great.
Which is great, yeah.
That sounds great. So I'm going to ask you a question, and it's going to sound like a job interview, but it's not. It's really of just pure interest.
Shoot, Joan.
So for you, Troy, what is the conductor's role? As you come to a community like Juno, an isolated community with a vibrant art scene, when you come in, what's your role? How do you see yourself?
Well, I think it really, you know, conductor really comes from the word to teach, so the Latin word. So there is a teaching element involved with it. And it's also really to inspire the musicians to play at their most passionate and capable level. You know, the conductor doesn't make a sound, so it's a very interesting sort of job. He or she has to inspire the musicians to play their best. And so I think there's a dual role of teaching and musical leadership that certainly I see myself in this community. And, you know, the players can feel that, and I think that having that energy and that leadership is palpable to them, and then they rise to the occasion. So
that sounds wonderful. And so just one more question, then we'll get back to the who, what, where, and when. Who are the people or the pieces of music that have inspired you?
Wow, that's a great question. You know, I have such a diverse interest, too, in music. I got into classical music, but I love listening to film scores. I listened to a lot of pop music growing up. One of the well-known classical composers that isn't performed too much is Walton. So William Walton is a 20th century composer. I did his, last season when I was up here for a guest spot, we did one of his pieces. So him and probably, of course, Brahms, who is one of the great symphonists of our time, and we're performing his works in January, one of his symphonies. So those two guys for classical. Outside of that, you know, growing up, I listened to a lot of Frank Sinatra, Barbra Streisand, vocalists influenced me a lot in my upbringing. So, you know, my other hat is as a singing orchestral conductor, which is a rare combination. So very diverse.
All right. It sounds great. Well, we're really looking forward. Welcome. And we're really looking forward to listening
to
the symphony and what inspires them and what inspires you. And
looking forward to performing for the community. It'll be wonderful.
That sounds great. So let's get to those performances. Laura, that's you. One more time,
okay.
Where and when, and the cost, please.
So the concerts are Saturday night, Sunday afternoon. Saturday is at 8, pre-concert talk at 7. Sunday is at 3, pre-concert talk at 2. The price depends on how old you are and where you're sitting, but we do have pay-as-you-can seats up in the balcony and stuff. And I also want to point out that one of our big fundraisers of the year is our silent auction, which happens to be this weekend. That will be in the JDHS Commons, and we've got some really great stuff. It's strewn all through our office right now. There's just amazing things that have been donated by businesses and individuals, and so that's going to be a lot of fun also.
That sounds wonderful. And I'm sure everything's on your website as well, is
yeah.
that true?
Yes, it's junosymphony.org.
Okay.
And the tickets are in all the usual places, Hearthside, the Jack, on our website, or you can buy them at the door. They cost more at the door, but that's okay. We want to have you. So.
Okay. All right. Well, you've got the drill. You've got to get down to JDHS this weekend and listen to the orchestra. 66 pieces. That's
Don't
impressive.
Miss it. It's
Absolutely.
Gonna be fun.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. Thank you so much
Thanks,
for joining
John.
Us.
Thanks, John.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Thursday, the 22nd of October, 2015. It's the birthday of John Gould, born in Brighton, Massachusetts, 1908. He and his wife settled in Lisbon Falls, Maine, on the farm where his great-grandfather had homesteaded. John Gould edited the newspaper there, where he got to meet a student from high school who was supposed to edit the school paper, but he got bored by it and wrote a satirical version. So Gould took the young man in hand and taught him how to shape up his writing. Student was Stephen King. 1942, John Gould wrote his first weekly column for the Christian Science Monitor. He continued that for more than 60 years. He wrote about baseball and night rides on sleighs, about fishing, about his mother's homeland of Prince Edward Island. One of his earliest books, Farmer Takes a Wife, was a big bestseller in 1945. It's the birthday of the novelist Doris Lessing, born in what is now Iran in 1919. Her father lost a leg in the British Army. He was a clerk in a bank. When she was small, the family moved to Rhodesia. Her father became a farmer there, and they lived in a mud hut that was thatched, but it was full of books that her mother had ordered by post from England. She went to an all-girls convent school, married at the age of 19, had two children, divorced, married again, had another child, divorced, moved to London at the age of 30. And a year later, she published her first novel, The Grass is Singing, set in Rhodesia. Her best-known book, The Golden Notebook, came out in 1962. A few years ago, a critic wrote, "Nobel or not, some people still think of Doris Lessing as either a one-book wonder, famous for The Golden Notebook, or a literary version of a crazy bag lady writing books about her cats and novels set on other planets." Doris Lessing, who said, "A writer falls in love with an idea and gets carried away. If you can imagine the sheer pleasure of having an idea and taking it, it's one of the great pleasures in my life." Here's a poem for today by Billy Collins entitled The Future. When I finally arrive there, and it will take many days and nights, I would like to believe others will be waiting and might even want to know how it was. So, I will reminisce about a particular sky, or a woman in a white bathrobe, or the time I visited a narrow strait where a famous naval battle had taken place. Then I will spread out on a table a large map of my world and explain to the people of the future, in their pale garments, what it was like, how mountains rose between the valleys, and this was called geography, how boats loaded with cargo plied the rivers, and this was known as commerce, how the people from this pink area crossed over into this light green area and set fires and killed whoever they found, and this was called history. And they will listen, mild-eyed and silent, as more of them arrive to join the circle, like ripples moving toward, not away from, a stone tossed into a pond. The Future, a poem of Billy Collins from his collection Aimless Love, published by Random House, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, now available on iOS devices. Subscriptions available at poetrymagazine.org. And by TIAA CREF, a global financial company dedicated to delivering financial outcomes that matter. TIAA CREF, created to serve, built to perform. Learn more at TIAA.org. Produced by Joy Biles with Kathy Roach. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Mondays are back at the Diamond Park Aquatic Center. Now open Monday through Friday from 6 a.m. until 8 p.m., Saturdays 9 a.m. until 6 p.m., and Sundays noon until 6 p.m. Fall schedules are now available online at juno.org/park/diamond park. For more information, call Diamond Park Aquatic Center at 586-2782.
Welcome back to Juno Afternoon on KTLO. Jeff Brown is the producer and engineer of the show. I'm Joan Pardis. You're talking Head on Thursdays. It is almost 25 minutes to the hour, and our third guest today is Johnny Prissett. He's with Alaska Powder Descents, a local heli-ski guiding company, and he's here to talk about Paradise Waits, this Alaska Powder Descents movie. It's going to be tomorrow night at Rockwell. So, hey, Johnny.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, Paradise Waits, it's a ski and snowboard film. So, you were one of the guides during the shoot, right?
Yep, yeah, it's a film by Teton Gravity Research. They're based out of Jackson Hole, and they They do a section of their movie every year in Alaska, and this year it was in the Neocola Mountains, and I had the privilege to be one of the guides on that, and we were out there for about 5 weeks shooting.
How many people?
The total camp, I think, was up to like 15 or 16.
All right. And so these films, these Teton Gravity films, we're talking about extreme remote skiing. Is that correct?
Yep. Yeah. They filmed all over the world for this one. I think Kosovo and Japan and a few other places. And then they always do an Alaska section in their movie, too. So they were, and Greece as well.
Okay. And so this is extreme skiing. So when you take a client up, do they normally do this type of stuff, or this is just like movie stuff?
You know, these guys are the top athletes in the world at what they do, so they're definitely pushing the limits of what is possible on skis and snowboards. But we do take people to, if they have the talent or the ability, we'll take people to similar terrain.
Okay. All right, so this film, have you seen it?
I haven't seen it yet, but okay. I've talked to a lot of people that have seen it, and they said it's really good this year.
Okay, great. So it's tomorrow night at Rockwell. There's a 6 o'clock, 6 o'clock, family-friendly show.
Yep.
Doors open at 5:30. This is Rockwell Ballroom. And then the main event, the doors open at 8, and it's 8:30 p.m. showtime, over 21. There's beer and wine available. And we were talking during the break, and that show typically sells out.
It comes pretty close, yeah.
Okay, so if people are interested in their advance tickets, where can they buy some of those?
There's a bunch of places around town. The Aurora Project, Sequence Board Shop, downtown or in the valley. The Rookery, Rockwell, Nugget Alaskan Outfitter, Foggy Mountain, Borderline, the Rock Dump, and the Alaskan Brewing Depot, and at the brewery itself.
Right, and those, it's like $12 if you buy it in advance.
$12 in advance and $15 at the door.
Okay, all right, and this is, it happens once a year every fall, right?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. I think we've been putting it on for about 5 years now.
All right. And then also there's like a party atmosphere. There's some giveaways and stuff.
Yep. Yeah, we have a bunch of door prizes from most of those places that I already mentioned. Eagle Crest donates a bunch of stuff, Alaskan Brewing, and then all the other places that I mentioned all have donated pretty good prizes, a lot of giveaways. And, yeah, it's a fun time. Usually it gets a little rowdy. People are starting to get excited about the ski season and stuff, so it's a good time.
Okay, and we were chatting that last winter you were up there for 5 weeks up in South Central.
Yeah.
Well, south of South Central.
Yeah, it's basically across Cook Inlet from Kenai, which is where we are, and the Neocola is about around Mount Redoubt.
Okay.
And, we were out there for about 5 weeks, and it was kind of a scramble, last-minute thing, and we set up a camp remotely for the athletes to stay in and stuff. So as well as being a guide, we were also construction crew and mechanics and fixing heaters and irrigating our camp when it would rain a lot and stuff like that. So it was a fun time.
All right. So as a guide, and we'll go back to this movie, and then I have a question, like, I don't know, like you're a groundhog and you're going to be able to, you know, predict winter. But anyway, as a guide, what do you think the most challenging for remote skiing, okay? What do you think is the most challenging part of being a guide?
It's so much different guiding for a film crew like this as opposed to just normal free skiers, so it's kind of two different things. But as far as the filming goes, you know, you're not really telling them what they can or can't do like you would a normal client. You know, they're there. You're there to give them advice and be there if something goes wrong, more or less. So they're actually making their own decisions on what they're going to ski.
Okay. And then with a client who comes up, you're saying, no, let's do this run.
Picking the runs yourself and getting them down safely and stuff. So that's probably the most difficult thing is picking the runs.
Okay. All right. If you're just joining us, we're talking with Johnny Brissett of Alaska Power to Descents about Paradise Waits, the Teton Gravity show tomorrow night at film tomorrow at Rockwell. It starts 6 p.m. for the family show and 8:30 for the adult show, Beer and Wine Over 21 Only. They're partnered with Eagle Crest, Excellent Radio, KXLL, Sony Atomic, and Alaskan Brewing Company, and a few more. And, all right, so what's your gut saying about this winter?
I'm going to stay optimistic. It's hard when it's raining like this, but I think we'll get some snow. And the great thing about having us Alaska Powder Descents here is even if there isn't snow down here, and even at Eagle Crest, we always have snow up in the ice field, so we're always able to take people skiing.
That sounds great.
Yeah.
That sounds great. All right. Well, hopefully we'll get buried this summer,
That's
this
right.
winter. All right. We're going to take a short break and we'll be right back.
Thanks for having me.
This is Bird Note. These days bring flocks of American robins to feed on fruiting trees and berries. Remember last spring when robins sang this lovely song? Could the robins you're seeing now be the same robins that nested in your garden last spring or spent the summer pulling worms from your lawn? Robin populations shift and change during the year. Some robins do stay as year-round residents. Others spend only the winter, having nested farther north. During autumn, still other robins pass through in waves on their way south. This hodgepodge of robin populations makes it hard to know where the robin you're seeing now spent the summer. In the early 1800s, John James Audubon had similar questions about a bird nesting in his garden, an eastern phoebe. He caught the bird and tied a string around its leg, probably the first example of leg banding for research. Would it return the next year? It did. Like Audubon's phoebe, the American robin that nested in your garden last spring will likely return to nest there again. And when it does, you'll hear its cheery song. To learn more about resident, wintering, and migratory robins, find us on the web at birdnote.org. I'm Mary McCann.
This month's Barn Dance, Odette Edgar will teach and call contra dances to live French-Canadian music by the Taku Gales. It's happening Saturday, October 24th, 7:30 to 11 p.m. at St. Anne's Parish Hall on 5th Street downtown. As always, you don't need experience or a partner. Free for JVs and AmeriCorps discounts for students and seniors sponsored by Juno Folk Dancers. Barn Dance, Saturday.
programming support is provided by Alaska Powder Descents, hosting the TGR film Paradise Waits at the Rockwell Ballroom Friday, October 23rd. The family-friendly show will play at 6 p.m., followed by a screening for ages 21 and up at 8:30. Tickets available at Sequence and Borderline.
Welcome back to Juno Afternoon on KTOO. Jeff Brown's the producer and engineer of the show. I'm Joan Pardis. And with us in the studio for our final guest of this edition of Juno Afternoon is Nancy DeCharney.
Hey.
Hello, Nancy. So hey. It's Arts Up. What is Arts Up?
Well, we have a few things going on, as is normal for this town. you've already spoken about the politics of water.
Correct.
So we've got that kind of covered. There's a lot of water coming out of the sky right now.
Right. So that's Juno World Affairs and Council and UAS.
Yeah.
And so that's the World Affairs.
And that
forum
goes this whole weekend, right?
Starts tonight and goes through Saturday night with the keynote on Friday, the Evening at Egan lecture with Professor McCaffrey, who was here, who was really fascinating.
Okay. So, and then there's the Abiyoki karaoke out at McGivney's tonight and open mic with Terry Tibbett at the Alaskan Bar tonight. So you can go hum around a little bit. Let's see. Learn to skate. It's skating time over. The Juno Skate Club is doing their things over at the Treadwell Arena. Start at 6:30. There's youth and adults for register. You can pre-register online if you like. It is the KXLL Zombie Walk. Yes. I understand that they actually have buckets of blood for you and everything. It'll be great.
That sounds exciting. That's Cope Park tomorrow night.
Starts at Cope Park. I don't remember. Where does it ends up downtown at Taqueria, or there's some sort of concert or something happening.
You just follow the blood. Yeah, it is Taqueria.
Yeah,
you're right.
And, you know, I don't know if I would want to walk really slowly in this weather, but that's how it is. Out at McGivney's, they have the Soul Review.
Tomorrow night,
Friday night at 10 p.m. So that's something. Saturday morning, a couple of big things going on. It's at 10 a.m. to 11, the Brotherhood Bridge dedication.
Oh, yay, it's done.
It's done. They're going to dedicate it. So, yeah, drive on out and drive back and forth across the bridge.
It's very wide.
Yeah, it's very wide. I think it has walking areas, too. There's the Polio Plus Fun Run at the Riverbend Elementary School Playground. You register at 9 o'clock, and registration is $10 to $20, I think, depending on your age. And that benefits Polio Plus. I think that's a Rotary type thing. That's also at 10, though, so you got to be in two places at the same time. It's tough. Saturday morning at the movies, it's the Gold Town Nickelodeon. They do family-friendly movies from 11 to 1:30. By family-friendly, we mean fun and for kids and everybody. Let's see. The Canvas has a whole bunch of really fun workshops and things going on. Just check out their schedule. If you just sort of feel like you need to get out of a rut and start doing some creative things, check out the Canvas.
But weather's so great. Why would you really
explore your creativity? Like watercolor comes to mind. We could be doing that. And this is the weekend of Back to the Future Marathon, and that's happening at the Gold Town Nickelodeon. So we've reached the future. Here we are.
Exactly. So they have that going on this week, and I bet this weekend, and I bet they have Rocky Horror coming for Halloween. Rocky Horror's happening.
Time warp. Here we are. Okay. So, and speaking of that, Avril Valise is doing a landscape watercolor workshop from 1 to 4 on Saturday at the Canvas. So
you
can do that. There's a pop-up museum event over at the Douglas Library from 3 to 4:30. City Museum is putting that together. I don't know what they're going to put in it. You never know what's in a pop-up. Also from 3 to 6, the Auk Bay Co-op Harvest Festival at Auk Bay Elementary School is happening out there. I think it's a fundraiser for the preschool, so stop on out. There's, as we just heard, the Barn Dance at St. Anne's Parish Hall on 7:30 on Saturday night. That's always fun. Odette Foster's doing the calling, so is Edgar, sorry. I went back to the future. Something happened there. I'm not sure what. And as you've already discussed, the Juno Symphony, they have what my father-in-law would call hummables. Great music that you will recognize and enjoy. It's the Shostakovich Festive Overture, the Meditation from Massenet, and the Dvorak New World Symphony. So great stuff, and don't miss it. And it's our new conductor, so
66-piece orchestra.
66 pieces. No wonder we all have house guests. they're starting an Eagle Crest instructor hiring clinic at Eagle Crest on Sunday. And there's the weekly ukulele jam over at TK McGuire's of 11. And there's the fourth annual zombie run. Now, I didn't know zombies ran, but that's at 2:30 to 4:30 over at Sandy Beach. So you can get tickets for registering that at Pavitt's and Foggy Mountain and Nugget Outfitters. So you can zombie stroll, I guess, over there.
A lot
there.
Of fun.
Yeah.
It's a lot of fun.
I think it's the outfits.
It's the outfits, and you also get tagged. Cool. You might become undead yourself.
I see. Okay, then. And there's also the Symphony Afternoon Concert, the fall concert. They do a matinee. And, you know, I suggest always coming to the pre-concert talks. He does them an hour prior to the start of the concert. And plus, that way you can find parking. So I suggest that. On Monday, there's a landscape oil painting at the canvas and sculpture with unconventional materials. More Back to the Future. On Tuesday, we've got stained glass and wheel throwing and exploring the use of color. Just a lot of things happening at the canvas, and more Back to the Future at the Nickelodeon. On Wednesday, the Clan Conference begins with warming of the hands from 6 till 10 p.m. at the Jack. That's free, and the sharingourknowledge.org is where you can get the whole schedule of events, and it goes on Thursday and Friday. There's a weekly old-time music jam at the Alaskan Hotel on Wednesday, and the ski film bar night at Louis. So there's quite a few things to do.
Yeah. And if you didn't actually remember everything Nancy said, you could check it out at jahc.org. Mm-hmm. So, Nancy, what's you and your staff working on? What are you brewing up?
We are brewing
across
up
the street.
Yes. Well, today, the next thing that's actually, do you want to build twig furniture?
Oh, you had talked about this last week.
Yes.
She's very excited about this twig furniture.
This gentleman is coming from Gustavus to build twig furniture as a workshop the first week of November. And apparently he's fabulous, and everybody likes twig furniture. So you can make some Christmas gifts. You know what I mean?
Sounds great.
So call us and register for that. We are also getting geared up for our Letters Aloud, and they are offering a letter writing workshop, which seems like, why would you have to have a letter writing workshop? But then you realize that often people don't write letters anymore.
What's this Letters Aloud?
Letters Aloud is a group of artists that have collected we got the Fame series, famous people's letters like Marilyn Monroe and Elvis Presley and I don't remember who all. And they will be reading them out loud. It's sort of a voyeuristic sort of thing.
So it's a company that comes in and...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they have music, live music and video and all that sort of stuff. But as part of that, they're doing a writing workshop.
When does that take place?
The workshop is Monday the 23rd, and the performance is Tuesday the 24th of November.
November. She did that off the top of her head. She didn't even look at a piece of paper.
I have that one written down. But we've been working on it. And the other thing that we're working on is our Lumberjack Beard Contest and the Naughty and Nice Wine Tasting and Beer Tasting, which is in December. And I see that Jeff has gotten started on his beard there. So
this is Lumberjack. What do you mean with beard?
You know, as a beard contest, what can I say? Pat Race and Aaron Suring will be the adjudicators this year. And for those of us who can't wear beards, there will be beards and mustaches available.
I am so jealous about that.
Yeah, just in case you need that. Winter needs a little protection. So we got a lot of things cooking up over there. There's a ballroom dance coming. First Friday is... Bob Knitzer and Lou Cacioppo from Gustavus, and there will also be a ballroom dance that night. And I really want to encourage people. There's a lot of dancing that goes on in this community, and the ballroom dances are lots of fun. They have a little teaching in case you're feeling a little like you've got two left feet. There's people there to help with that. Sometimes it's live music and sometimes it's DJed music, and I'm not really sure. And actually they're kind of interested in finding bands who would like to be the live music. It's a nice opportunity to sort of hone your skills as a dance band, to have some dancers who can say, nope, wrong beat, you know, or sort of help you with that sort of stuff. So it's a nice community effort to get out and dance.
So when is that ballroom dance?
That's first Friday in November. Right. We have a lot of things like that going on.
All right.
And I really appreciate their efforts. They split the proceeds of the door with the Jack as a fundraiser for the building, which is really nice.
Wonderful.
Yeah. That's I don't know what else is going on to talk about. It's always something around here, though.
I think that is plenty. So you can check it out at jahc.org if anything has caught your interest. And if not, go there anyway. And something will.
Yeah, if you'd like to add your stuff, give us a call. Mm-hmm. And also, we print this out and send it out as an electronic version. If you'd like to get on that email list, also give us a call, and then you'll get this in your mailbox.
Sounds great. All right, Nancy, thanks for all you do. We're going to take a short break and be right back. One thing that Nancy and I did not chat about is the Filipino community is having a food court, a taste of food from different regions of the Philippines, and that is this Saturday at 4 p.m. at the Filipino Community Hall at 251 South Franklin Street. It's 4 p.m., and then there'll be a fun game afterwards. So that sounds pretty interesting. It is 4 minutes to the hour, and it is currently 42 at the airport, 43 downtown, and 41 in the Mendenhall Valley. It's going to drop down to the high 30s tonight. Tomorrow, numerous rain showers, highs around 48. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy, chance of rain, lows around 39. Saturday, mostly cloudy. Saturday night, mostly cloudy. And Sunday, mostly cloudy. Hey, tomorrow at 3 o'clock, join Andy Klein on Juno Afternoon to wrap up your week here at KTOO. He's got a great lineup. You could always listen to Juno Afternoon at ktoo.org. Thank you for listening. Jeff Brown is the producer and engineer of the show. I am Joan Pardis, your Thursday host. And you're listening to KTOO in Juneau, Alaska.
Battleground Productions and KTOO are delighted to present the first season of an independent audio series, Brass, the adventures of a family of Victorian science geniuses who return to London only to be confronted with a sinister criminal conspiracy involving many of their old foes as well as several new ones.
As the creature of pistons, cogs, and armored plating lowers its head, Gwendolyn slowly backs towards the wall, anticipating its charge.
You can hear Brass Tuesday evenings at 7:30 on KTOO News.